Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report on lockdown. And I am coming to you following a couple of technical issues right up until the time of broadcast, which is why we're a couple of minutes late. But thank you, everybody, for frantically refreshing for a few minutes. We are, in fact, here now. Myself and Michael Shore, who joins us once again on the show. How's it going, Michael?
Right, with apparently solution and worse lighting, but it's good to be on the show, Johnny.
You know, if it works, it works. If people can hear us, that's great. Sometimes they can't. If they can see us, that's great. Sometimes they can't. And we're really just hoping that our internet connections will work, because both of us had massive problems in the last hour.
That's exactly right.
Everybody who's already coming to the chat, thank you very much for doing that. As always, please hit the like button so that more people will get notifications about this stream. We get a lot that we're going to be talking about through the course of today. What I'm alluding to in the title there is Fox News, not in general going back to lying about coronavirus. They never took a pause on that. But specifically, they are now minimizing the number of deaths that have already happened and attempting to convince their audience to ignore the numbers as they continue to go up. We're going to have a number of different pieces of evidence in that area. A bit after that, we've got a Republican congressman out with a new ad that some are saying seems a little bit racist. We're going to evaluate that. Updates on insulin pricing during the pandemic. What regulation changes in slaughter plants might have to do with the next pandemic. And at the end of the show, Michael and I are going to be having a little bit of a conversation about the new dynamics of the Democratic primary and how the general election is likely to go if Joe Biden is, in fact, the nominee, which is looking like today he will be. So that's how we're going to be closing things off. If you want to hear that, stick around for the rest of the show. Throughout, as always, we're going to be reading your comments, your super chats, as well as any tweets you send to hashtag TDR Live. We've got an awesome team of producers who are going to be tracking that and putting it together for me so that I'm a little bit less frantic during the show than I have been the past couple weeks when I was doing that myself. So as of this morning, we had another horrible day in terms of the number who have died as a result of coronavirus. If we take a look at the numbers, yesterday was not quite as bad, slightly short of the all-time high of nearly 2,000, but still very high. And those 2 days are just such a 1-2 punch of a significant number of people dying, or at least that's what the professionals who report this stuff want us to believe. Others, in a position of authority in terms of media or even power in politics, don't necessarily feel the same way. Here is what Donald Trump has been saying about the numbers who have died, and more importantly, what he wants you to think about the numbers that might die.
That was a projection of, I guess, 1.5 to 2.2 million people would die if we didn't close it up. That's a lot of people. So if we do a number that's tremendously smaller than that, now if we did close it up, the numbers got to 100 to 220 million people. So if we can stay substantially under the 100, which was the original projection, I think we all did a very good job, even though it's a lot of people.
Okay, so what we have there is him saying, and I think Mehdi Hasan pointed out, that they always want to anchor you to that original projection, not to cause you to take this seriously and be willing to perhaps sacrifice some personal mobility and all that in the near future, but to say that if literally anything other than that happens, we'll have done a great job. And he's not just implying that, he's directly saying that over and over. And so they're now saying it might be something like 60,000, and they're already pitching that as some sort of great victory, which I find to be ominous, honestly, Michael.
Yeah, well, the insurance to that would have been the notion that you had Fauci and the doctors out there saying these things, these numbers, confirming these numbers, forecasting them. You had the medical community sort of saying that these are numbers that we're forecasting. So you knew that anything that came in under those numbers was going to be a Trump victory dance. So I'm not surprised we're going to get that. The question is anybody going to be looking at the way this White House handled this with anything but scorn once this is all said and done? Not necessarily because of, you know, that they were responsible for every death, but the lack of preparedness and the not getting the straight talk and then having the medical community challenge them every day. And then you look at his poll numbers. Even when they bumped, they didn't bump very much. A president, and I think we might have talked about this last time, a U.S. president in a time of crisis should see his numbers go through the roof. They have for terrible presidents and terrible situations, and they didn't go through the roof here. They always come back to earth, but they didn't go through the roof here. So I do think that you have people looking at this with a great deal of skepticism, even though we know what the president's doing here.
Exactly. And, you know, he's going to get an assist, which we're going to go through a number of different media figures who are attempting in one way or another, and the tactics do vary, to prep people to not be that concerned, even if the number does continue to significantly rise. But as someone pointed out in the chat, I do want to at least acknowledge that he's talking about original projections there, and he's referring to some of the original models, which are obviously going to be somewhat loose. But let's also bear in mind a projection that he made not too many weeks ago when he said the number of cases is only 15 and soon it'll be close to zero. Bear in mind, the number of cases wasn't 15 when he said that. It was something like 60 to 70, but he projected we'd be at zero a month ago. So the projections have changed fast.
It was going to wash through.
It was going to wash through. Just everyone be calm. It'll go away. It'll go away. Much like a bear that is mauling us right now.
Right.
So look, it's not just Trump. He's going to say what he's going to say. But Fox News especially, you know, they have in one form or another been doing everything they can to hamper the ability of our country to deal with coronavirus from the very beginning. Right now, what they're doing is a 1-2 punch of implying that agreeing with Trump, that anything short of 100,000 or a million deaths is going to be some sort of big victory, but especially don't even trust the numbers that you're seeing. And, you know, we've been tracking this a couple times now. It started off with Diamond and Silk last week saying the numbers are just made up. They're just making up fake numbers. And that was just Fox Nation. You know, that was only the online component of the biggest media company in the country. So we shouldn't be too concerned about that. But then it rapidly spread over the past few days to, you know, to Brit Hume and others. And now, in fact, it's hit the straight news anchors. Take a look at Harris Faulkner here.
The federal government now is classifying all COVID-19 patient deaths as such, regardless of whether any other underlying health issues were a factor. This as the death toll in the United States just topped 13,000. How many of those people had other health risks at play, though? And maybe it wasn't, in fact, COVID-19 that caused their death.
Okay, so she's saying if they're sick with literally anything else and they die, it's being tracked as being caused by coronavirus because that's what killed them. But that bothers her because these people had underlying illnesses. Why is that being counted? Even though this is like some sort of like big realization that they've had in the past 48 hours that it's combining with other illnesses to kill people. We've known about that from the very beginning. That's not something that means we should ignore coronavirus. That's one of the reasons we've been as scared as we've been about it, because it preys on people who are susceptible to illness. Not only them, there are plenty of totally healthy young people who are getting sick and even dying as a result of this, but especially those with compromised immune systems or something else at play. They now think that if somebody with a compromised immune system catches coronavirus, dies of it, that for some reason that shouldn't be counted as a coronavirus death. I have no idea how you come to that conclusion. And again, this is not Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity. That's Harris Faulkner. She's supposed to be one of their news people, right, Michael?
Well, I that's where I was going to say what she said is as egregious as what you calling her a straight news anchor. She's someone who does drop in opinion there with some constancy. And sorry for the background noise here, but I think that what you're seeing though is exactly what the problem with this. If all of a sudden there was something that was afflicting only the weakest among us, and it was a disease, and it was killing people who otherwise would not be dying. Maybe their life expectancy wasn't what yours is or mine is necessarily, but it wasn't. They weren't about to imminent away. Then that's a national and worldwide emergency, and that's what we're dealing with now.
Exactly. And as we were saying yesterday, when this stuff was starting to go around, does anyone think that they would be like tying themselves into mental knots to excuse away these deaths if it wasn't Donald Trump or another Republican president that was in office? Whether it's their opinion people or their straight news people or straight news adjacent people, what passes for straight news on Fox News, does anyone actually think that they would be doing that? And we predicted, by the way, that this would become sort of the universal go-to position, and it is, in fact has, I would say faster than I would have expected, spread throughout the network and you know, other affiliated, the online right-wingers, the right-wing writers and things like that. And I understand that Harris Faulkner probably feels like, I'm just looking at this critically, and I want to make sure that we have the most accurate information possible. Maybe that's what she's doing. But the end result of a person waking up and turning on Fox News and going through a full day of it is that they will be left with the impression that you can't trust these numbers. And so if it hits 20,000, if it hits 50,000, I mean, really, what does that even represent? Does that mean anything? And they will not think that it means anything. And so Trump, he can be a buffoon and he can bungle this thing. Maybe it'll hurt him a little bit with some slightly more critical thinking independents. I don't know. But in terms of his base, they're going to believe that it's nothing really.
Yeah, that's true. And his base, though, is the one that are the ones that this is all being addressed to. This is get out the vote in a way, right? This is to make sure that, because they know how fragile their position is as a candidacy, how by what a slim margin electorally and statewide within the states, really popular vote within the states that they won by. They have to make sure that they get and keep every single Donald Trump voter. So they keep doing this because it's an us versus them, and we're in the us versus them era, you know, anyway in an election year, but it's certainly in a much more pronounced way now.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
As more and more people are dying from coronavirus, take a look at the way, in a just casual little chat, Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly talked about this.
I want life back to normal. Can you fix that in a simple way?
Oh, man, I wish I could, you know.
Me too.
But we're making little steps. Bernie Sanders, you know, he's gone. That's really good for everybody. The projections, as you just mentioned, are down to 60,000. I don't think it'll be that high. 13,000 dead now in the USA. Many people who are dying both here and around the world were on their last legs anyway, and I don't want to sound callous about that.
Oh, you're going to get hammered
care.
For that.
I mean, a simple man tells the truth.
Well, you mean people that have underlying conditions and compromised immune systems, any virus you're saying would...
Okay, yes. So Dr. Bill O'Reilly, who he believes the numbers will be even lower. Based on what? Nothing. He doesn't know anything. He literally knows nothing. And any infection would have finished them off because he's a doctor and he knows that they were on their last legs. Why are we freaking out about these people dying?
I also like a simple, these must be the two most complicated men in America. If in fact a simple man tells the truth.
Yes, they're quite complex. And by the way, so look, I thought about going back and in the end, I didn't care enough to actually go back and pull quotes or anything. But the idea that if people are old, and if people are sick, and especially if they're old and sick, and they're close to death anyway, honestly, just let them die. That's their approach to this. How many videos do you think they made attacking death panels under Barack Obama under the ACA, the conspiracy theory that they had? The idea that you wouldn't care about extending every life as long as possible. They were so incensed by that, fired up for literally years to attack Obama about that. Now it's like, okay, so like 14,000 older sick people died. Why are we criticizing the president over this? It's a right. bit of hypocrisy.
It's inconsistent, but it's also the benefit of the audience they have now. Because what Donald Trump has done, and we know this, has brought a lot of people into being interested in this, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's at the voting booth, you know, in different ways. People who were not interested in politics, who paid zero attention to it. Everything that happens, every word that's said to this audience, and not to all of them clearly, but to many of them, is new. So context and what you may have said about death panels doesn't matter, because all that these people know is what has happened since Donald Trump has risen in American politics. And so it's actually a benefit. It's a nice luxury for these people to have. But of course, we're here to say why it's so dangerous and why it is such an incredible lack of integrity as well. And that's the big part of it. But it really is an amazing dynamic that you're speaking to people who know nothing about history very often in history. And that's an important advantage.
Yeah, love, by the way, also that after all that we found out about Bill O'Reilly, him being driven effectively out of show business as a result of it, Sean Hannity still has him on. Like, he's still buddies. You know, what does it matter if he ruined women's careers, was a predator for a number of years? Let's chat, buddy. Let's talk about how it's not a problem that thousands are dying literally every day. And by the way, while Bill O'Reilly and to a lesser extent there, Sean Hannity, are just absolutely horrendous in the way that they're addressing this. As I alluded to earlier, it is coming in a number of different forms. So let's see, you have Tucker Carlson every night is doing shows about how it's not as bad as we thought it might be. And that, by the way, again, you have to understand context. He's not saying that and thus saying, and thank you to all of the responsible medical professionals who advocated for social distancing and staying at home. It looks like it's working. He's saying this was all a waste. We shouldn't have done it. We should start up the economy. And it's like we said at the very beginning, the goal of all of these measures will be hopefully to be so successful that we will be attacked as having over-responded effectively. And we're seeing that already. Even though he said those two shows where he has made it effectively, this isn't that bad, have been the 2 days with the most deaths nationwide from coronavirus. I don't know what today is going to look like. I hope that it plummets. But if it's high, I don't anticipate that he's going to backtrack off of this narrative.
Right. And you know, I forget who it was or if it was somebody talking about this. So I don't have the specifics on this. But someone was talking about how the Democrats want people out of work to make it look like the Trump economy is bad. And they want more people to die to make it look like Trump didn't do enough, which is obviously not true for 99.999% of people who are Democrats or otherwise who are Americans. The other part that I think you should also notice that Tucker Carlson is the person who has Bill O'Reilly's time slot. So there's a great consistency across the grid at Fox.
That is true. And the consistency goes even further. Laura Ingraham's show last night was flawed projections sparked panic. And so again, we should not have locked everything down. It was a big waste. And that was last night. This morning, Brian Kilmeade took a scornful tone as he talked about the projection, saying, quote, "The fact is, when somebody says 200,000 people die, oops, I mean 60,000, and it's not going to be right away, it's going to be in August. That's how good we are doing and how off the models were. You have to wonder, as much as social distancing is working, I wonder if the economists are going to get in that room and say we have to stand up this economy in some way before we're not going to be able to stand up when this is all said and done." So really fast, because we have a follow-up immediately to that, but so he says, oops, it's only 60,000. That's nothing. I mean, so we lose like a Vietnam of American citizens. Like, ah, who cares about that? Acknowledges the social distancing is working and potentially is the cause for the numbers being revised down, and says, ah, but even so, let's let some economists in. Even though the economists are saying that you will do devastating damage to the economy if you send people back to work and many more people die. Thankfully, really fast, in response to that, Steve Ducey says, right, but Brian, it's still 60,000 people, which is a staggering number. So he is, as always, the voice of reason there.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, it's whatever comparisons you want to make. If you want to make latter-day comparisons, you say 17 9/11s. You can just keep going and putting it into the vernacular of today, and it's just as astonishing. I mean, thank God for Steve Ducey, but he'll probably be fired.
I think he'll probably change his tune. He does occasionally, him and Brian Kilmeade will occasionally say something sort of reasonable, and it's a trap to give them credit because it almost always is an outlier that won't be sustained. And I want to say one other thing about this, because the saying that the numbers are made up, obviously, I hate that they're doing that. I hate the how just everyday and normalized spreading, you know, baseless conspiracy theories have become, even for the most well-known, most watched, highest paid people in media. But the argument they're making there that if only 60,000 people die, then it will have been a waste to have shut down the economy. That bothers me because it's not like we haven't gone to great lengths and spent tons of money to avoid loss of life in other areas. You made the reference to 9/11, that this is potentially going to be far many times over 9/11. So when 9/11 happened, we lost thousands of American lives. And if we assume that the politicians in their response to it were being honest, which I don't assume, but if we do assume it, all of the actions they took that they said were designed to stop that from happening again, how many years of war did we launch? How many trillions of dollars did we spend? How many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of civilians abroad had to die because we wanted to stop 3,000 Americans from dying in another 9/11? So we were willing to do all of that and continue to, by the way. We're still at war in multiple countries as a result of it. That has stretched, for many people watching the show, that's been their entire life, the response to 9/11. But we've shut down the economy for less than a month now, and Fox News can't wait to get things started. This is unacceptable. Decades of war, trillions of dollars spent, that's okay if it hypothetically saves American lives, but to definitely save far, far more American lives, I mean, we can't have the NASDAQ go down. That's not acceptable. I'm heavily invested. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
And the other, I mean, just on that quickly, John, is that, you know, had we not shut down the economy, had we not shut it all down, it's obvious what would have happened. We have doctors telling us we're saving lives every day because of it. So it's ridiculous. And that the inverse is always something you have to look at.
Yeah. And by the way, I saw someone mentioned in the comments, but that there are, you know, news broke this morning that the federal support is imminently ending for coronavirus testing sites, the public ones, as the pandemic peak nears. And look, I hope that it is the peak. I mean, we're projecting at this point. It's not like we called up the pandemic and asked, and it was like, yeah, we're gonna peak around, like, you know, Saturday. We hope that if they open things back up, that we won't have, you know, we won't double dip into it. But the only way we'll know.
But if it's the peak in New York, if it's peak in California and Louisiana and Illinois, but it's not the peak in South Dakota, it's not the peak in Iowa, it's not the peak in other states, and it could just go right back up. I mean, people, there's no uniformity of how we're dealing with this other than on a federal level and with, you know, banking, et cetera. And that's not even uniform. But the notion that just because it goes down in places that are quote unquote important, those aren't the only important places, A, and B, it hasn't even begun to go up on a curve in some of these other states.
Yeah. Yeah, let alone in Wisconsin, we can expect that in, you know, 10 to 14 days, we'll probably see a massive increase in numbers because they went ahead with the voting. Yeah, it's not, we don't have any better medicine against it. And it's not like its power, its vigor wanes with the phases of the moon. It's every bit the disease it was 2 weeks ago. It's just that people are getting kind of frustrated and a little bit bored, I think. Paul Brown is a former Republican representative from Georgia who is hoping to get elected once again. And so he has an ad out. Let's take a look and see what we think of the way he's presenting himself.
In uncertain times like these, the right to defend yourself, your property, and your family could not be more important. Whether it's looting hordes from Atlanta or a tyrannical government from Washington, there are few better liberty machines than an AR-15. You see, Marxists know that Americans will never submit to socialism and place government on the throne of our hearts without a big fight. Well, I'm just not feeling like giving up my guns to the government. But I've decided to give away an AR-15 to one lucky person who signs up for email updates from paulbrown.com. Now remember, you must be at least 17 years old to enter.
Okay, I think we've heard enough of him. So there's a lot, I think, of issues there. What has made the most headlines is that he needs his AR-15 to defend against looting hordes from Atlanta. Michael, what do you think? You've watched a lot of political ads over the years.
I mean, you know, it does play to an audience, and the AR-15 giveaway is sadly something that has worked in terms of getting support and getting people out and getting people interested, whether it's a raffle, a giveaway, a pick out of a hat type of thing. In some communities in this country, it works. There should be something that the FEC does to ban this kind of it seems like it's a little different than giving away a T-shirt. It doesn't seem that way. It is. And I think the FEC should step in on these sorts of issues because it does present people in a way that, you know, that we don't want to be presented, especially, I mean, you know, talk about political correctness or whatnot. This is over the top. I think a lot of people could agree to that.
Yeah. And so I love that he wants to brand it as a liberty machine, but he's so uncertain that his audience will get what he means that they have to add in the arrow pointing to it with liberty machine written on it. It's like, I mean, maybe just call it the AR-15 then, I guess. And Eric sorry, go on.
To have such an ordinary name as Paul Brown and be able to come up and still get paulbrown.com, that's an achievement.
So that's true. That's true. I saw Eric Wall in the comments said, I thought a voting booth was a liberty machine. Yeah, I like that better, actually. But look, as I alluded to, the problem is the looting hordes from Atlanta. So he's running the 9th district in Georgia, which is not Atlanta. And just random statistics so that you understand the demographics here. His district is 8% Black or African American. Atlanta's 54%. But I'm sure that that has nothing to do whatsoever with the fact that he's not talking about his district. He's talking about the scary people who might come out as a horde to steal your TV. And that's not in the ad, but in the interview afterward, he doubles down saying these people feel entitled to your TVs and your cars, and they're going to come flooding out. Because again, they're not humans. They're a force of nature. They're going to come flooding out of the cities to steal the things that you and your perfect, lovely white family have worked so hard to achieve.
And that works in rural districts. I mean, that does help, shockingly, in rural districts. And so people campaign in that way. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. So I want to let him respond. So he was asked about this in an interview, and he said only the liberal press would take that kind of position. There are a lot of white people in Atlanta as well. I feel better. I don't know about the rest of you, but I feel better. Goes on to say
47% aren't black, apparently.
Exactly. He says it's about black people having the means of protecting themselves just as much as white people or Hispanic people or Asian people. He also suggested that the interviewer was racist and said that he had been a keynote speaker at any MLK Day celebration. Well, I mean, look, no claim that the racist thing you said wasn't racist would be complete without calling the person who asked you about the racism a racist themselves. That's just, the countdown starts as soon as the question goes out there. And
right. And I just because you represent the James Earl Ray part of the MLK celebration doesn't really help you.
That's a good point. By the way, whenever one of these figures pops up, especially one who had previously been in elected office, I always do a bit of a search, see, you know, what they made news for back in the day. And back in 2012, he had a quote that I remember actually from the time. I had not remembered him. But at the time he said, all that stuff I was taught about evolution, embryology, Big Bang Theory, all that is lies straight from the pit of hell. It's lies to try to keep me and all the folks who are taught that from understanding that they need a savior. There's a lot of scientific data that I found out as a scientist that actually show that this is really a young Earth. So he was a scientist and he found scientific data that the Earth was 9,000 years old and had been created in 6 days. The paper is waiting for peer review.
Yeah. But, you know, and he's just, we should, just to give you an idea of the kind of person that comes out of Paul Brown's district, it's he's running to replace Doug Collins, who's leaving that seat. So that gives you an idea of what you're dealing with there in Georgia.
Exactly. And, you know, we talked about how Kelly Loeffler, she's being challenged by Doug Collins, and she obviously has been horrendous recently, all the insider trading stuff, all that. But then it's like, so she gets replaced by Doug Collins, who's a terrible guy. Doug Collins, to replace her, has to abdicate his seat. So now maybe Paul Brown will be the next guy. It's like, you can't, you want consequences for these individuals, but one of the consequences will be that they will be replaced by another in a long line of clowns.
Right. It's why so many people are saying, let's just pipe down about Kelly Loeffler. Let's just let, let this stuff happen. We don't want Doug Collins in the Senate.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Prior to this pandemic, we still had a lot of problems with healthcare, health insurance, the price of you know, caring for your own health in this country. And a big one that had received quite a bit of focus over the past few years was the ever-increasing price of insulin. Well, we now have some good news. Pharmaceutical manufacturer Eli Lilly said Tuesday that it will limit the out-of-pocket cost of insulin to $35 per month to offset financial hardships due to the coronavirus pandemic. The copay cap will cover the majority of the company's insulin under the Humalog injection and is open to the uninsured as well as commercially insured people, but not to Medicaid, Medicare, or Medicare Part D patients. I'm not sure exactly why that last part is there. And the thing is, like, look, taking totally just by itself, this is obviously a good thing for the people who have desperately needed financial support when it comes to paying for insulin before this, many of whom will be both in need of insulin and will have lost their jobs. But as a lot of people have pointed out when this news broke, kind of seems like they could have done this before if they're doing it now. I don't know. I don't run the company, but it seems like the jacked up price was not being driven by actual financial concerns.
Yeah, certainly they could have been better than they have been. I don't know the numbers and where it could go in terms of how low it could go. And again, I mean, the medical business is what the medical business is. And so much of it nauseates me in the way that they do their pricing. So I don't know where it would come from. But I tend to think that if they can come down to 35, they could have come down to something more manageable for many Americans previously. And what does this mean after the pandemic? What does this mean going forward? And, you know, the other part of this is that so many of these drugs that are being tested right now, and it's not necessarily insulin, but diabetes patients are among those who are most vulnerable to COVID. So many of these drugs that are being tested are now in shorter supply for the people that need them because people are testing. We know that with malaria drugs. We know the people that are taking those malaria drugs that the president is sort of ballyhooing as kind of a cure-all for the coronavirus and COVID. They're going to be at a shortage pretty soon, and that's scary to a lot of them. So this whole idea of supply and demand is a big part of this as well. It definitely does mean that this price could have come lower long ago. And when this pandemic is over, it should be lower than it was when this started.
Yeah. And to give some historical perspective on the rise in the price, insulin prices spiked nearly 100% between 2012 and 2016, often costing thousands of dollars, even for insured people with high deductible plans. No, that's 2016. We know that it didn't stop then, obviously. The price has continued to rise. And I have never seen presented any sort of feasible reason based in access to materials needed for its construction, relicensing. I haven't seen literally anything that has explained why it's more expensive now than it was a couple of years ago. And to go back even further in history, in 1923, the discoverers of insulin sold its patent for $1, hoping the low price would keep the essential treatment available to everyone who needed it. Reached for comment, those discoverers are spinning rapidly in their graves. Because that was a great plan, but unfortunately, people who are incredibly shady have gotten control over it. And I think it was Shkreli, you know, one of the worst people of the past few years in public life, who I believe that that's one of the drugs that he massively increased the price of. So look, it's good that they're doing this. You know, as a skeptic, I'm inclined to believe that perhaps it's a brief PR move, and I wonder how long it'll last. But if you need this, and people do, people have died, you know, recently in the past few years because of not having access to the money needed to pay for the ever-increasing price, it shouldn't be happening. And as you know, I think it was Eric Wall pointed out, you know what's cheaper than 35? Free is cheaper. And for something that you need to sustain your life, especially if you are already paying for your insurance, the idea that you should suffer more financial stress it's not comprehensible to a lot of Americans.
Yeah, and it's different than sort of like the temporary rent relief, right? That you know, you can have landlords not charge rent for three months or whatever it is. That's different because those are people that own property that make a living off of this. But when you look at what the drug companies are doing, it's a totally different thing. If they can come down for 3 months, they can certainly come down and with some degree of permanence because they have to. It's an obligation and they're making enough money anyway.
Yeah, and this is, I would just add this to the list of like all of the things that to progressives seemed like solutions that needed to happen before the pandemic. There are things that are starting to happen during the pandemic or that are people are starting to realize during the pandemic. And I hope that once it's done, once you're not in quarantine, you don't think about coronavirus, I hope that people don't go back to sleep effectively on this. Like, I think people are realizing some of the fundamental flaws in the way that healthcare is provided and paid for in this country. And it could be solved not just under emergency conditions, but going forward during all of the other emergencies that we don't treat as such. Today is the first full day without Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, and barring some big change that could come in a variety of different ways, including the theories that the convention could have some sort of big switch up, it is looking like Joe Biden will be the nominee. The general election will be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, almost certainly under conditions somewhat similar to today in terms of the coronavirus. It is going to be the issue that shapes the election. And that is something that myself and Emma Viglin, my guest yesterday, talked about, made us incredibly concerned. You know, I acknowledge that the polling has Joe Biden up right now, at least nationally. But I remember that from 2016. And so I'm incredibly nervous. We are joined by Michael Shore. I'm curious, the people that you're talking to, you have more experience than me in these national elections. How would you rate your confidence that Joe Biden can win in November if he is the nominee?
I mean, first of all, experience is one thing, but the electorate changes and the people that are involved change. So it's difficult to say that just because there's experience, there's certainly things that my perspective has that a lot of people who are much more fully invested in one candidate or another don't have. But to say that just experience, I could not have been more dead wrong about 2016, but I know that was an anomalous election to a degree and a lot of people were wrong. I've known and I've seen what has appealed to Joe Biden on the campaign trail for the past 15 months. People, voters who I've been speaking to with great regularity, talk about electability in a way that is difficult to define. It's a hunch thing. It's the idea that this is the person I believe who has a better chance. My dog barks too. Better chance of beating Donald Trump than that person or that other person. And so I've come to understand, and sorry about the dog, but I've come to understand and agree that enough people think that. And I do too. I mean, I do think that there is an electability thing here with Joe Biden where he probably has a better chance with the people that he connects with, even though connecting is going to be a difficult thing now. The other advantage Joe Biden has, which any of these candidates would have had, is that this election is a referendum on Donald Trump. It's nothing more right now. It is not about big ideas as are discussed in your super chats and the TYT audience. And it's a shame in a sense that it's not, but that's just how it shook out this time, is that Americans by and large seem to want to get rid of this person, which shows why Joe Biden is up. And these numbers are a little different than 2016 in that this is an incumbent president. And when you are a favorite against an incumbent president, there has not been a lead like this early in a very long time. I think it was since the time of Harry Truman. I'm not going to hold to that, but I think that's when it last was. So I think there are reasons also to be encouraged about his ability to win. And finally, one of the things that the audience here won't like to hear, and it's not me advocating it or saying it, is that the Democratic Party, you know, a lot of these progressive ideas in an election that was not about issues were kind of set aside this time. And I don't think that I think that the Democrats feel that they are going to appeal to a different kind of voter and don't need as much support from the progressive. But the party itself knows that they need those people going forward when you look at the age disparity. So it will behoove them to invest in those voters now rather than, you know, not because of the 2020 election. I don't think it's as necessary personally, but I do think going forward, they have to do it in a long-term way.
I agree. I do think, you know, as and first of all, not everyone agrees with me, but I think that the Democratic Party needs to, both to solve the problems that America faces and also for its own interests, needs to move in a more progressive direction. I desperately want them to do that. I think that that's better for everyone. It is a win-win, and not the third win for the Republican Party. They would lose, but that's one of the benefits. But they don't seem to be doing much to actually do that, which is frustrating. But I want to ask you about a few of the concerns that myself and others have been expressing about a Joe Biden nomination for some time. So let's go, you know, individually through a few of these. One concern I have is that he has seemed very eager recently to effectively distance himself from the election. He wanted Bernie out, which I get. Bernie was running against him. He didn't want to debate him even when he was in. He didn't want to have any more debates. And the reason I talk about that is because we're in a time where coronavirus is overwhelmingly dominating the news cycle. Trump has a national stage every single day to talk. There was already less focus on the Democratic primary. Now that, you know, effectively we're not going to have very competitive, you know, races going forward and we're not going to have any debates, there's going to be much less focus on Joe Biden. And I don't see anything from Joe Biden that makes me think that he's looking to fill that gap with anything new, anything to draw attention to him. And I feel like if they're like, you can't beat an incumbent president if you're effectively not even part of the conversation, not really being considered. What do you think about that?
Well, listen, if I were advising Joe Biden, first of all, I thought the where was Joe thing was totally overblown. But if I were advising Joe Biden, I'd advise him to do exactly what he's been doing to an extent, because Joe Biden doesn't have a job. Bernie Sanders had a job. He was a senator who was voting on important stimulus, who was taking in the you know, so much of what was being presented by the White House and by the nation. And I think that that's important. So too does Donald Trump have a job that obviously it requires him to be there every day on this. Joe Biden, I think, had he been issuing statements every day and been doing the things that some people wanted him to do, I think it would have looked weak because he could not exact any change upon what was going on. What he's been doing is having this kind of shadow cabinet of people that he's consulting with. People don't know about it. Nobody's paying attention to this race. And a lot of people, again, hard for this audience to digest. For many people, this race has been over since Super Tuesday and certainly over a week after that. So I do think that that's something that people have to take into consideration, is that the gear up for the race when you can run that race. You had nothing to gain because you were already going to win the nomination. It was pretty clear where it was going. I think that that's what he should have done. Could he have done things differently? Sure, but I don't think markedly so, and I don't think it would have made a difference in this whole conversation. Going forward, I think that's going to change.
Someone said in the chat that I should plug my op-ed. So if you want more of what I was saying there, the op-ed is available at The Hill. Does Joe Biden really want to be president? You can take a look at that. So I guess
I read your op-ed, John, and A, I think he does, and B, I thought it was well written.
Thank you. And I don't mean that he doesn't have the inclination. I'm saying, is he willing to do what is necessary to win? Like, and as Emma and I talked about yesterday, like, obviously we weren't big fans of Hillary Clinton. It was pretty clear. But nobody ever doubted that she was going to fight. I think that she strategically made some significant errors, could have fought in different ways, certainly. But she definitely wanted it bad. Joe Biden, to me, just seems a bit too relaxed, like a bit too willing to, you know, like to Skype into CNN for 2 minutes and then mostly call it a day. I acknowledge I'm in a bubble. I am biased, but that's my perception.
Well, I think your bubble, I mean, I wouldn't just sort of disclaim it because there are a lot of people that agree with you. You're not alone with that opinion. But I do, you know, I think that these times and these circumstances right now are like nothing anyone has ever been through. So I think it's all a guess as to whether or not he's doing it right or not doing it right. But I think that the notion is he can't really run for president just yet. He cannot do that. And he has plenty of time to do that, and he will do that. And then I think you will likely see someone who wants to be president. Again, going back to what I said before, the other thing that makes this different is this is a referendum on Donald Trump, this election. It's exactly the election Joe Biden has wanted. And so I think he's prepared to run in this way as just an alternative to Donald Trump for the moment.
Okay, so I have two more concerns I want to raise to you. The first is how Donald Trump is going to run against him. And so we already know what he's saying about, you know, Biden not being able to follow what he sees on TV and stuff like that. So I'm worried that that is just going to be like the narrative. And then the other is that the allegations from Tara Reid, Joe Biden didn't have to answer a single question at a debate about it. I haven't seen him asked about it on CNN or MSNBC, which is obviously what you want if you're Joe Biden. But Trump is going to talk about it on the debate stage. He's going to talk about it in ads. He's going to talk about it literally every day. So at some point, a reckoning is going to have to come with those allegations. My preference would have been that we had that reckoning before he was locked in as the nominee, but it's going to come. How concerned are you about those two potential narratives being injected on a daily basis, including on the debate stage, from Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, the Tara Reid thing, I think, is if you're going to have someone to run against and where that becomes a problem, I think Donald Trump is the right person to talk about it with. I think Donald Trump is going to spend far more time talking about Hunter Biden than Tara Reid, because to him, nobody cares, and certainly he doesn't care about Tara Reid. I think that he's going to go full bore on Hunter Biden. I think, you know, he's going to go full socialist too, even though as we sit here, and especially this audience in this space knows that Joe Biden isn't a socialist, whoever the nominee was is going to be painted as a socialist by the other side. And I think those are going to be what you're going to hear in the narrative from Donald Trump most. And then also as a way of dividing the Democratic Party, which would be strategically, if I were advising Donald Trump what to do, is to try and divide the party as much as I could, rather than go to those sort of sexy images, both literally and figuratively. And then the first part of that, you know, I think that when you if you look at, you know, Joe Biden and how you engage him, I do think that when it comes to, you know, two older white men engaging each other in politics, Joe Biden is going to be tougher. He's going to be more pugnacious in a way. He's not going to laugh at, I mean, he'll laugh it off because he laughs a lot off in show, but he's not going to laugh off a lot of what's being said. And he has a different audience now. These suburban voters who like Joe Biden in states that both are red and blue are going to come to his defense in ways that they would not have for Hillary Clinton. What Joe Biden, even for the people that don't like Joe Biden, Democrats, people in our super chat right here who don't like Joe Biden is liked. And Hillary Clinton was not. And that is a big difference between 2016 and 2020, is that people came in with a visceral dislike of Hillary Clinton that doesn't exist as much or nearly as much with Joe Biden. And that's what makes it a little difficult for Joe Biden, has made it in the primaries very difficult for him. Nobody's ever said bad things to Joe Biden about Joe Biden in almost a half century career in politics. It took him a while to get used to it. It's why he was so shocked when Kamala Harris said what she did at the Miami debate. It's why he will not be as shocked when he hears Donald Trump say those things.
One more question. So yeah. I think I know what you're going to say based on your other answers, but I assume you are not of the camp that believes that he's going to be pulled and replaced at the convention by Cuomo or whoever.
I don't. I really don't think so. I think that first of all, Black Americans who came out in droves in the South and across the country in the primaries for Joe Biden would be really upset with their party and wouldn't allow it to happen, I think, on a technical level. And there doesn't seem to be any reason for it to happen. I mean, barring a major misstep, barring something that we don't know about the nominee right now, and Joe Biden's been pretty vetted over 50 years, I just think that I don't see that, or nearly 50 years, I don't see that as happening. I don't think the convention wants it, and I don't think it's the place for it to happen. Also, the convention now happens late in August, just before the Republican convention. The Democrats do not want to seem in disarray a week before the Republicans go out there and talk about disarray. So I think there's a 1% chance. Top.
You should debate that with Cenk, because he seems pretty convinced.
Well, debate with Cenk all the time, and Cenk's right a lot, but Cenk's also, you know, wrong a lot.
As the federal response to coronavirus has gone forward, people are obviously concerned about exactly what sort of aid, what sort of policy changes will be produced in the short term. But a lot of us are also wondering long term, what effect this pandemic could have on our domestic politics. You know, what sort of silver lining can come from this horrible tragedy? And, you know, I was very interested to read an op-ed just a couple of weeks ago. The coronavirus makes a special case for boosting our social safety net. We're going to get a graphic in there in just a second on that. And so I'm very excited to be joined by the author of that op-ed, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, Katrina Vandenhoevel. Welcome to The Damage Report.
Thank you, John. These are times, I mean, first of all, may courage, compassion, and community prevail. These are times where I hope you and yours are safe. But we do need to think about what kind of country will emerge, what kind of political, economic, social system will emerge from this crisis. And I wrote that, you know, the social safety net is a great immunity booster. And I think we need to rethink where we are. This crisis, as you know, has revealed the cracks, the fissures, the weaknesses of our economic, political, social system, so that someone like Bernie Sanders, who's played such an important role in shaping our political debate in these last 5-6 years, who suspended his campaign yesterday, ideas that he's been talking about, suddenly reality endorses those ideas: Medicare for all, job protection, universal basic income, universal childcare, empowering workers, ensuring perhaps that government keep people on payrolls, thinking through what a planned economy would look like. Because you know what, John, the job numbers that came out today, I think they're looking like 1932-33, Great Depression numbers. Yeah, so we need massive government intervention in wise ways, not bailout for corporations. There's some jobs obviously involved with corporations, but putting people first and healthcare, meeting needs of hunger, of safety, of security, and redefining what security means in these times is critical. So I think we're at a moment where if we can think anew, if we can expand our collective imagination, even amidst this horrific crisis, we can emerge in a more powerful way and a more secure way.
You know, we probably agree quite a bit on both the needs that might not currently be being met by the relief efforts that have already passed. To some extent, I think the silver lining so far that I have seen, not from Washington necessarily, but from regular people, is they seem to be sort of getting that this is revealing not just new issues, but it is magnifying the issues that were already there. And I don't know if you've seen the change in polling, like approval for Medicare for All, for instance, which has spiked, especially amongst independents, in the past few weeks. Do you think that to some extent, if politicians are going to move in a new direction, that it might be driven by a new desire for these sorts of policies amongst the population that's being awakened to some of these inequities during the pandemic?
Absolutely. You know, as I said earlier, reality, facts on the ground, facts in people's lives, the way people are living now, what they're seeing in their communities, in their neighborhoods, among family, colleagues, at, you know, distant workplaces, reminds them of what we haven't lived with a real security. And Medicare for All is, as you said, its popularity is increasing. Bernie Sanders and others have even said that in this time we should have a form of Medicare for All, because it's just obscene to think of people going without testing, going without care amidst this pandemic. So I definitely think empowering workers' rights, free public higher ed will be back on the agenda, because these ideas have been popular, interestingly, but now, of course, given this jolt, this boost. And I would also say something I wrote about this past week, John. You know, we've spent so much in this country over the last decades in a bloated military. You know, the nukes we've built, the carriers, they're being used as hospital ships. But think about how we have failed to invest in confronting pandemics, nuclear proliferation, mass migration. Those are the security threats and challenges of this next century. And it should force us to think very hard about how we invest, what our priorities are, and what true human security means. And it's not just buying more military equipment. So I hope there's a rethinking there as well.
I hope so. And I think, especially when you point out how much money we've spent on protecting American lives in regards to military equipment, I think someone put it as, you know, we have nearly endless bombs, but people are having to sew their own masks.
That's right.
At home. Like, we can't even distribute those. Like, that's how off
our priorities are. I mean, we don't have the protective equipment we need at this moment, even as a mighty power, as a globalized economy. And I think the other thing I would like to add is we're heading into, you know, primaries, as people know, have been postponed. We saw in Wisconsin something I think was very dangerous, where the Republican playbook appears to be to weaponize the crisis so that you don't have safe, secure voting. And the Supreme Court, in its decision, which allowed the Wisconsin primary to proceed, it reminded me of Bush v. Gore 2.0, but I wrote a column on vote by mail. As you know, four states already use it. A quarter of people in 2016 voted by vote by mail. You know, people in this country fought and died for the right to vote. Let us not see people die in order to vote come these next primaries, and certainly not in November. So there's good legislation that has been put forward, but there needs to be more muscle and more funding in order to begin to really have a cogent, coherent, effective mail-by-vote system in these next months.
And, you know, so originally, I think in the first major relief bill that was passed, the Republicans were going to allocate $100 million for, you know, helping to prepare for future elections. They got that up to $250 million, which is still, you know, about 10% of what we we might need. And so I'm sitting here hoping that more will be done. But in the meantime, while I'm waiting for legislation, Donald Trump spent yesterday much of his press conference
denouncing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what are your hopes for what will actually in the end be passed, and what will Trump allow? What will he veto when it comes to prepping for the general election?
This has to be put on a curious scale. It should be in the Republicans' interest, even though voter suppression by Republicans has been their playbook. But about a quarter of the electorate is 65 or older. Don't fact check me on that right now, but I believe that's the case. So their electorate is older, and they should want to have safe voting procedures. I think we need to shame the Republicans. Are they really going to lead people to die because they're not going to enact more funding, provide more funding for something that is legitimate, has been used, is effective? So I think we need to do shaming. We need to do mobilizing. I don't know how much can be done on the state level. That's something to explore. You have four states which already have vote by mail. Can states do it? But I think shaming the Republicans and also perhaps pointing out that it may be in their self-interest might get them somewhere. But Mitch McConnell has his own ways of operating, as we well know.
Katrina, you wrote about, you know, your evaluation of the different stances in one of the past debates that Biden and Bernie took, where Bernie is talking about systemic issues. He's addressing the crisis, you know, but he's also talking about longstanding problems, where Biden, and even since then, has seemed more focused on dealing with this crisis in particular. So since you wrote your op-ed, Bernie has left the race. We have some initial idea of Biden. I saw it was announced today that he's going to support lowering the age for Medicare down to 60, which is not the same thing as Medicare for all, should be acknowledged. What do you think the prospect is for, through the course of the rest of this primary, more of Bernie's proposals being incorporated into the Democratic Party platform and into Biden's platform in particular?
Very good question. So Bernie Sanders suspended his campaign, but he did not end the struggle. His campaign has been a movement in many ways, and he will continue to gather delegates, even though he will not be running in the next primary. So he will come into whatever we have as a convention, a virtual convention, a real convention now in August, with enough delegates to play a role in drafting and crafting the platform, which will be vital. But in the short term, we need to continue to build out the Sanders campaign, and he knows this, as a movement. And just today, 8 or 10 youth activist movements from Sunrise to Justice Democrats put forward a statement really seeking from Joe Biden a commitment to some of the key Bernie Sanders policies. It will be a struggle, but Bernie Sanders understands, and so do the movements, that no change comes without a struggle, to paraphrase Frederick Douglass. And the inside-outside motion and mobility and movement will have to play a role in trying to move Joe Biden. He will not be a systemic structural thinker like a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, but there are demands that he, Biden, bring in Sanders people, Warren people, and there's an effort to kind of keep the corporate establishment Democrats out, which is unlikely to happen, but to at least have a balance of forces in a Biden administration could be effective with the outside movement and motion of younger people, of movements. He's going to have to win over a part of the Bernie Sanders electorate, a big part. And young people are mobilized to defeat Donald Trump, but they need to be mobilized around the issues they've lifted up, as have others.
So you, as you say there, he's going to both want to and need to appeal to this part of the electorate. But there's sort of two dueling issues. One issue is that he doesn't have the positions right now. The other right. is that there is definitely a gap of trust that, you know, this group is not predisposed, a group which I consider myself very much a part of, is not predisposed to necessarily believe his overtures that might be coming. So from your point of view, what do you think he will need to do for it to be taken as authentic? Is it going to be about the right VP or the right appointments?
I think people matter. People matter. Appointments matter. I think his commitment to issues matter. This is early on. Just yesterday, Sanders suspended his campaign. But he's going to have to, Sanders' campaign will continue the movement and will need to get commitments from Biden. You know, I think there was also commitments to bringing in important labor people, movement people into the administration. And I think, you know, trust but verify. You can't trust, you know, in my mind, it's, you know, politicians always need to be moved from the outside, the inside-outside politics. That strategy is critical, particularly with Joe Biden, who has, of course, you know, this is his third campaign, you know, and he's been in Washington for a long, long time. So I think a lot of thinking is going to need to go into appointments, commitments, the platform process, and also the rules process. Let's not forget there were changes made in 2016 so that the party establishment, the superdelegates, couldn't play such a big role.
Yeah.
So I think that needs to happen. And I think the movement, the Sanders movement, also needs to focus on down ballot, because there are enormous number of really progressive, important candidates, people running who need to be put back in play. So you have the future AOCs and Ro Khanna's and Pramila Jayapal's and Ilhan Omar's. So that's critical.
You know, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that's actually as sort of my last question. My fear is that those sorts of candidates, many of whom are going to be, you know, engaged in primary challenges against incumbent Democrats or possibly Republicans, they've always had a difficult path. They generally don't have very good name recognition. They're generally much better in terms of who they'll take money from, which can mean less money overall. Well, now, in the middle of a pandemic, the sort of AOC model of, you know, large amounts of volunteers doing a lot of on-the-ground canvassing, those sorts of things, that's going to be much harder, at least in the short term, as long as the pandemic is going on. Do you feel like the barrier to entry for these sorts of candidates is going to be high in comparison to incumbents who are going to be able to fall back on, you know,
It's a very good question, but I do think the insurgent candidates, as I'd call them, have shown that they can use digital tools, digital organizing tools, horizontal distribution, as Bernie Sanders did in 2016 so effectively. They are really talented and smart about it. And if you have Sanders using his enormous lists and also the ability, as some have showed, not all, to raise small donations in big numbers, that's critical. I mean, I think that overcomes the traditional barrier to entry, which is money, money, money. By the way, I worry that Joe Biden's spending more time on phone calls, Zoom calls with donors than he is with movement people, and that should change. But I think the jury is out, the verdict is out as to whether this moment is going to really hurt insurgent candidates, because I think there's creativity and energy, and the Sanders, quote, movement needs to rally around those insurgents to build them up, to amplify their voice, amplify their small donor giving possibilities. So I think they're real opportunities, even in this crisis.
I think so, and I think you've done a great job in spotlighting several of them. Katrina,
thank you
both for your writing and for joining us today. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Thank Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.